But first, to Britain and our regular commentator, Ian Dunt, editor of politics.co.uk. Ian, where are you?
I am in my living room, which is a room that I have spent a quite extraordinary amount of time in over the last three weeks. In fact, I've seen very little else, apart from occasionally the kitchen, the bathroom, and the bedroom.
Are there other Dunts? I've never asked you this.
Well, there is the Mrs. Who is occasionally doing law lectures in the bedroom and also the living room. One of the few advantages of this period is that you start to get a very intimate understanding of your partner's professional life, which in this case means that I now suddenly understand huge amounts about contract law, which I frankly didn't particularly wish to understand before, but now consequently do.
And do the Dunts like Boris have a puppy dog?
No, and I do wish I did have. I have to say, I've never massively wanted a dog, but I think in this period, it's deeply unwise to not have a pet because you've really lost any reason not to have it. I mean, you can't go out anymore, so there's no concern about leaving it in the house. So there is a hole of absence where I think a puppy should be in this house, but alas, it is too late for me to go buy one.
Now, Ian, the really shocking story, and I've read your writings on it, concern the Brits and the EU and what looks like their idiotic refusal to accept EU help in the crisis. Take us through it.
Yes, indeed. So there is a procurement scheme within the EU for the protective equipment which medics will use when dealing with coronavirus. Britain, in addition to that availability, has a few other streams of procurement. I mean, it has a sort of national procurement stream, which you can use basically for pandemics. There's also, on a sort of local national level, and there's the NHS Trust, the actual sort of hospitals themselves can procure whatever they want. But this fourth element, the EU stream, seemed like it would be a requirement. After all, I have spent, when I started writing about this, I put out a call to doctors and nurses to tell me, you know, what was the situation with the equipment where they were. And I received literally hundreds of direct messages, of emails, of phone calls, of people saying, well, look, we're scared. Like, we're being sent in without the equipment. We've read the WHO guidance. We've read the Public Health England guidance. We do not have that equipment. I was talking to doctors who were getting, the overhead projector paper, you get these sort of long plastic sheets, and sellotaping it to their heads so that they would have something to protect them because they weren't being given visors, others who were buying it in sort of DIY shops. And there is a shortage of masks, not so much the surgical masks, but of the second kind of masks called FPP3, which protect you when there's a generation of aerosol. So in other words, when you put someone on a ventilator, when you're working in anesthetics, anything that might create aerosol, which helps for transmission. Britain had access to this EU scheme. It was invited in. It's obviously outside of the EU now, but it's in transition, which means that it's treated as a de facto EU member state. We know now that British officials took part in meetings last month now on that issue, and yet Britain did not take part. Now, when the government was asked why, they said, well, we're no longer an EU member state, which is a completely irrelevant response to the question, given the fact that we had access to the scheme. Then, incredibly, I mean, you know, this is the sort of level of nonsense that you start to get from this cabinet. They said they weren't a member because they didn't see the email, which we know is false on the basis of the fact that they attended those meetings. And even if it wasn't false, would raise such questions about the competence of the government that it would be no better than the reality of the situation. So it seems, in fact, one can only conclude that Britain is not taking part in that procurement because of the same old boring culture war against the EU. And for the time being, that has actually blown up in their face rather spectacularly. Even very critical figures towards Europe are asking questions of why on earth would we be doing this to ourselves for such pitiful reasons.
Is Boris still held hiding? And I'm sorry, that's a poor way of putting it. Is he still self-isolating?
He is indeed, yes. So it seems that he has coronavirus. He's sort of locked away. Dominic Cummings, his second in command, or as some people like to call him, the sort of secret Prime Minister of Great Britain, is also showing symptoms and has been hidden away. So is the health secretary. I mean, it seems, to be honest, I mean, the way that politics operated for weeks on end, as if this wasn't happening, we had this rather sort of absurd spectacle of these press conferences where the prime minister would say, we want everyone to stay at home. while he himself is surrounded by people and quite close to them, and journalists were sort of packed in there. So, of course, Westminster was really a pretty good place to transmit COVID. And so it seems to have taken place. So one after another, we're seeing quite a few leading lights of the government, including the Prime Minister, now operating in isolation.
We've taken the decision in this country, or rather, the decision has been taken for us, that we don't really need a parliament for the time being. And so whatever's being decided here, it doesn't get an awful lot. We'll get no effective parliamentary supervision, but Parliament has shut down in your neck of the woods too.
It has. I mean, it's going to be closed for recess. I mean, the Easter recess has been massively expanded because of this, but it's been closed for the next month. I mean, I can't see any manner in which it really would be opened when that month is over, and yet there isn't any real significant institutional moves to create the kind of scrutiny that we need for the time being. So, I mean, the Speaker seems as if he's not very keen on the idea of conducting Parliament virtually. There have been some calls to
Could it be conducted virtually?
Well, there's nothing to stop. I mean, we have the technology. I mean, what it requires is people to not think so much about tradition and to think rather in terms of how do you ensure that you have democratic scrutiny at a moment when the government is amassing quite extraordinary degrees of executive power. I mean, even in wartime, we haven't seen the kind of powers that they have right now. In most cases, that is perfectly legitimate. One understands why they are taking these powers. But they are nevertheless very strong powers. Now, in our efforts to scrutinize it, we've just had a coronavirus bill go through just before Parliament broke up. Efforts to scrutinize it are typically met with some very bitter, angry reactions online of people saying, well, look, you need to not criticize the government right now. What we need is leadership. You know, these powers are all completely legitimate. To which the answer is, fine. These are not unfair points to make, but it is precisely in emergency situations like this that it is most incumbent to exercise critical thought and to scrutinize the government. At the moment, it is quite hard to do that. We don't have any of the normal structures in Parliament. There's quite a lot of animosity towards those who are doing it in journalism. There are some avenues that could be pursued. There's a thing called the Liaison Committee, which is a sort of select committee with the heads, the chairs of all the other committees, who get together and talk to the Prime Minister. Now, that could be put on a virtual basis and at least used as a sort of daily mechanism to scrutinise government now, but there's no movement towards it for the time being. And of course, this comes in addition to the fact that the Labour Party is pretty much non-existent at the moment because it's in the middle, or rather coming to the end of, its protracted leadership campaign.
Although Jeremy has said his voice will not be stilled, I take comfort from that.
I'm glad that you do. I have to say, for my part, I cannot wait until the day when I no longer have to listen to his voice. He's, now that he's on his way out, he's doing these sort of exit interviews. I mean, one of them he did the other day, just extraordinary to the extent that it was tone deaf, where he basically said, look, I've been proved right about everything, and it just needed the coronavirus to show how, because now the government is, you know, throwing lots of money at the self-employed and the employed in order to try and sustain some basic level of demand in the economy. Now, it was an extraordinary thing to say for a couple of reasons. I mean, the first one is, you know, just on point of logic, what he's saying is incorrect. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn's proposition, which I happen to agree with, is that there should be a larger role for the public sector in British economic life. That is entirely distinct from what you do in an emergency situation on a sort of Keynesian program as a fiscal stimulus to try and keep your economy going. But more astonishing, I think, was on an emotional level, what it revealed about Jeremy Corbyn, that even in this situation, at this state of emergency, at this kind of level of crisis, his only real manner of looking at the world was to think, well, this completely confirms all of the things I've thought about ideology and myself for the last 40 years, which is that Trotskyism is true and I'm correct in my appraisal of it. So really, again, even as he goes out, you think, yeah, you're very much going out as you came in, with very, very little to offer.
Now, at a time like this, suddenly the ratings of approval for a national leader increase by an order of magnitude. We've even seen it with Donald Trump, and we're seeing it in Australia with our Prime Minister. Has that same effect enhanced the reputation of Boris?
Yes, it's exactly the same process that we're seeing here. I think you see the same thing with Macron in France. And of course, the breadth of that phenomenon gives you some indication of how little contact with detail that it has. This is, you know, we see the same thing during periods of war, we see the same thing after a terror attack. These are the moments that people like government, that they want some sort of sense of security and leadership, and that is what we are seeing here. Now, I have to say, it doesn't correspond really to the manner in which the government has behaved. We've seen pretty good policy for the last 2 or 3 weeks. The questions that are raised, really, by journalists, and to be honest, the journalists that are raising this are on the left and the right, the front page of the Daily Mail, one of the most sort of vigorously right-wing and reactionary newspapers today, is asking questions about why there is such failure on securing tests for COVID that might allow some degree of normalcy in public life as people get tested, find out whether they've had it or not, and get back to work. Now, most of the questions now being raised about Prime Minister is, what exactly were you guys doing in February? Because February, you know, in January, people were still quite uncertain as to what was happening. In March, you got the sense the government was starting to understand the seriousness of it. And too slowly, but certainly it finally got there, got to a destination where it said, right, everyone needs to stay home. February is the month that is really in question, where there was enough evidence to show what was happening. And yet the government seems to have been pursuing this herd immunity strategy of thinking maybe it's better if we back out and not taking care of the logistics. So on the data, really, it's not clear that Boris Johnson has performed particularly admirably. But because of the trend we see worldwide and because of people's need for protection, he is at the moment getting very, very high popularity ratings.
In 10 seconds or less, I understand the Brexit negotiations continue.
Yes, extraordinarily so. So even as they become more rational on most of these medical issues, the government still remains completely deranged and myopic on the issue of Brexit and insists that it's going to complete the negotiations this year, something that, if anyone believes it, it is only government ministers that do.
What? And surely some people must be suggesting extending the deadline.
Oh, almost universal, and including among Brexiters. I mean, they can't even meet at the moment. I mean, if they're going to have meetings, it's on Zoom. But of course, you know, the British negotiator, you know, went down with COVID. Michel Barnier on the EU side went down with COVID. I mean, there's no one to do the negotiation. I haven't heard any sane or sensible person suggest that this could possibly be done in time,
okay,
given the severity of what we're facing.
Prince Charles listens to the program regularly, and he's just sent a tweet saying that he's willing to lend you one of the Queen's corgis. So that's good. That's good news. I'm very proud that you carry this weight in the UK, just as you do on our little wireless program.